You're listening to Rust Belt Running. I'm Adam Wheeler. You can find me on social media at Wheels Up in CLE, joined by Andrew Hettinger, who you can find on social media at Andrew Runs a Lot, and Matt Martin, who you can find on social media at Matt Martrun. If you want to follow all of us, there you'll go to Rust Belt Running.
Instead of starting you off with a bunch of ads, we're going to start you off with different ways that you can support Rust Belt Running. First is run coaching. Adam, why don't you tell us about it?
It's personalized run coaching. It takes into account the schedule that you have to get your runs in, the goals that you have, as well as the base that you come to us with. You talk to us about what it is you want to be doing, the time that you have to do it, and we come up with a personalized plan that fits your needs, works on you towards your goals, and helps provide a bird's eye view on your training to make sure that you don't plateau, to make sure that you're doing the correct training that's appropriate for you, and to get you showing up on race day confident that you're going to be ready to hit your race goals.
We all know running in groups can be more fun than running alone, and your training can be the same way. So grab a couple of your closest running friends and we can train your group of up to five friends together. With a personalized group plan, you can get the camaraderie of being on a team, but the personalization to fit your group's needs, similar to our individual training. Click on the RBR Teams link on our website and go smash some PRs with your friends.
And if you're looking for other ways to support the show, go to rustbeltrunning.com. There you can find different merch, t-shirts, bags, all kinds of things. All of that helps support us and helps us keep bringing you new stuff on our social media platforms, to the podcast, to our training programs. There's more than one way to support our show. So this helps us keep the show ad-free, keep us from making you go to a Patreon to subscribe for stuff. We want to keep it free. But yeah, go to rustbeltrunning.com, support the show, sign up for coaching. We'd love to have you.
Andrew, how are you doing, bud?
Oh, dude, I'm great. The kid is, I'm stoked because this week the kid returned to school.
Yeah.
And, you know, I started taking Mondays off to focus on some Rust Belt Running stuff. And I get to be by myself again on Mondays.
Right.
So I'm jacked. I'm jacked about that.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioning that because I can't tell you that I know what that experience is like because I don't have kids, but I see what it's like with my brother and my sister. And for as much as they love their kids, there is that they're getting older and it's back to school season and it's completely empty house. And you can just see like the stress level dropping when I talk to them. And it always cracks me up because go ahead.
No. No, I was interrupting at a bad time. You finish your thought.
No, you're good. You can see the stress level drop because it's that paradox of like you really, really love your kid, but at the same time, like once you have a kid, you don't have you time anymore. Your time is completely about being a parent. And so like any little bit of that you can claw back is just gold.
Well, and my son is 10, and it is the worst age of it's awful because he you know, they think they're awesome. Like these kids think they're amazing. Like they're getting to that age where they think they're cool. You know what? Whatever. You think you're cool and whatnot, and you want to start trying to, you know, talk like a badass to me and your mom. Whatever. But don't be like dependent on us still.
Yeah.
So I feel like in like 5 years when he can like, when I don't have to remind him to like take a shit, like, I'll be a little more okay with it.
Yeah.
Like I have to remind the dude to eat in the morning. I'm like, what? I don't remember that for me, but like, it's just, it's that awful age where you still have to watch every little thing they do.
Yep.
But he's getting that like teenager angst and it's just like, yeah, I can't, I'm very excited to be able to start getting work done again on Mondays. I feel like I'd slacked. I mean, some of it's because I do love my son. I'm here talking shit about him. But, like, and we've done good things. Like, we've gone for bike rides on the towpath and stuff. That's been, you know, that was kind of a fun thing we did this summer. And we look forward to doing, you know, on longer runs in the future. But, yeah, I'm very much looking forward to my Mondays by myself. So that's the highlight of my week. And I get to enjoy it for 1 week before we have Labor Day weekend. So
here's your little tease. I broke into youth coaching under 11s when my brother was that age. And in my entire time coaching kids, I went everywhere from 10-year-olds to high school seniors. And I can tell you easily the least favorite time that I had coaching was coaching under 11s, because everything you just described is exactly how they are. And they're like that in all facets of their life. Like, I remember coaching these kids and like, yeah, I had a younger brother, but I wasn't used to dealing with 10 or 12 of them all together. And you get them together and they do think they're cool and they think they're able to be independent, but they're not. And they have that attitude. And it was probably coaching high school at the same time that kept me in coaching, because if that had been my only experience, I think I would be like, you know what? Screw this. Like, this is for parents. I don't need to deal with this crap. And it ended up being funny because I stuck with the same group all the way from when they were U11s through when they were high school seniors. So it was cool to see them grow up and get out of that phase. Mm-hmm. But man, as a newly formed adult who had just entered college and was thrown into coaching all of these 10-year-olds, God, it was awful. I had no joy doing that. And
high school kids are cool.
They're great. You can have adult conversations with them.
Yeah. I remember when I worked with youth group kids when I was early 20s. Like, I could not stand it when I'd be like working with the middle schoolers. I hated it.
Middle school's
every
awkward.
Second of it.
Yeah.
It's a lot of the same thing.
Yeah.
And you know, they're still figuring out a little bit of who they are. And I don't know, like, there's some of the psychology behind like what's going on at that age is whatever. But like high schoolers, like some of the high schoolers that I worked with, like I'm still friends with, you know, we got real close and became friends, and you know, I talk to them to this day, and you know, now I get to see them get married and have kids, and that's cool. One of them, there was always a joke that for some reason, I don't even know how it started, but that I was his dad. And so to this day on Instagram, whenever he posts a picture of him and his wife and his kid or something, I'm like, I miss my grandsons or something like that. Like, I always say stupid shit like that, but yeah. So there you go, guys. I used to work in churches at with youth. So take that. There's your little nugget about me for the day.
All right, we learned something new about Andrew.
What's the highlight of your week, Adam?
Oh, so this is a good story. So I mentioned on the podcast last week how I'm making this career change, and the thing that sucks about it right now is there's just an intense amount of studying and certification that I have to do. Like every company that I'm going to be contracted with to sell, you have to certify with them. And it's largely, they just want you to know their policies and know their products. And we simply got kind of hired into this late. So we're really doing a lot of work, maybe like 5 months worth of work that could be done at a leisurely pace over 4 or 5 months. We're trying to squeeze it into like 3 months. So it's just a lot. So I've been spending a lot of time over my parents' place the last couple of weeks because my mom and I are both doing the same exact thing. Well, you know, here are my parents that have been kid-free out of the house for like about 10 to 15 years now since everybody has left. And, you know, so seeing them interact with like, say, their pets, like they're their kids now is funny to watch. And they have 3 cats because they live out in the country and they want these cats to be mousers, you know, keep mice out of the house or whatever. But these are cats that are fully capable of taking care of themselves. They do not need to be babied, but my parents insist on babying them. And so I'm over there the other night and my mom is into like, get the cats into the house mode. I'm like, mom, they're fine. Like, it's a nice summer night. It wasn't one of the nights when the storms rolled through. I'm like, they stay outside all night. They're going to be just fine. But she insisted, got to get them in, got to get them in. So the one cat, Izzy, is by the back door. Mom's like, oh, great. Izzy's here. I'll let her in. She opens up the door and lets Izzy in, not noticing that Izzy has a mouse in her mouth. So she lets her in, and then she realizes the cat has a mouse. And now she goes into this panic, like, no, 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 I don't want her to eat that thing in the house. Get her out, get her out, get her out. I'm like, okay, the mouse isn't dead. This is that phase where the cat's going to play with its food a little bit before they get rid of it. So Izzy, seeing me, kind of startles and drops the mouse, who now sees a lifeline and takes off in the room, in the family room, and gets underneath a shelf. The cat takes off after the mouse to get under the shelf. The two dogs don't know what's going on, but they see that there's a cat tearing around at breakneck speed, so they want to tear after the cat. So it's just animal after animal tearing through the family room as the cat tries to get the mouse. My mom panicking, like, don't let the mouse get out, don't let the mouse get out. Mom, which animal do you want me to focus on right now? My dad, meanwhile, this is like a TV sitcom, he's sitting in a chair, but he doesn't hear very well, and if he doesn't have his hearing aids in, he's kind of oblivious to what's going on. He has no idea what's going on. Finally, the cat gets the mouse, and we usher it outside. And I was like, did you get the cat? Yeah, mom, got the cat. Did you get the mouse? I don't know, mom. I got the cat outside. What do you want? You know, the dogs are still tearing around. So finally, everything calms down. And my mom's doing is the mouse inside? I look outside. All right, Izzy's got the mouse. It's fine. 30, 45 seconds have elapsed. And finally, my dad peers around and goes, oh, did you guys get that mouse out? Is the mouse still here? What's going on? It's just completely oblivious for 45 seconds. And it's just, I'm watching this. And it's one of those moments where I realize, like, I am in a sitcom scene right now. Like, I'm living out something that would have been written into a sitcom. And, you know, so I had to share that in the family thread with my brother and my sister. And that then gets my mom going, no, that's not at all what happened. I was completely calm and fine. No, mom, you were not. No.
Okay. I know your mom. She is got a little bit of Sarah Hoover in her.
Mm-hmm. And, oh, yeah.
And so I'm like picturing her, like, you are not doing it justice at all. Like, I can imagine how she would be freaking out, partially probably hysterically laughing. But yeah. Also just straight up panic mode all at the same time. Like, that ability to like exude multiple emotions that are like antithetical to one another. She has that ability, like somebody like Sarah Hoover. And I can absolutely picture this happening. I love your dad though. Like, I love him just like chilling during the whole thing.
Completely chill, oblivious. And then like 30 seconds later chimes in and is like, oh, did you guys get that mouse? He hasn't moved from his chair, by the way. All he's done is like just kind of like leaned forward and turned in the chair to look over. Oh, yeah, completely oblivious. Yeah, no, it's funny that you mentioned my mom being a little bit like Sarah Hoover, because there is that ability to just ratchet up the emotions to, you know, beyond a level 10. And
yeah,
when something happens that is like out of the ordinary, she just kind of like, she's not able to like pull it back and like dial into like, let's take care of this. So it's just like she's shouting like five different instructions at me, and they're all counterintuitive to what the last instruction was like. And it's like, which part of this do you want me to focus on right now? We're trying to herd three of our own animals plus this terrified mouse. Yeah, no, it was amazing. It was like living in a TV sitcom. That's my highlight.
Right. Well, one of my lowlights of the week was I had to listen to that episode that you and Matt recorded last week.
Which was the low light, ripping on the Braves?
Well, I don't understand how you rip on World Series champions. I just wanted to bring up a couple points about that, because y'all brought up how loaded that Indians team was, and you're not
so
wrong.
Good. No.
But I also want to point something out, though. That Braves team had like six Hall of Famers on.
Oh, yeah. No, like, that Braves team.
Braves team was fucking way loaded. But I wanted to read a quick excerpt from an article. It's actually a Greg Maddux quote.
Okay.
And this is from Greg Maddux.
Okay.
We always heard, and I quote, "We always heard in Atlanta how we got strikes called and other teams didn't.
Yes.
But if you go back and watch the tapes, the ball 2 or 3 inches off the plate, that was a strike. Was being called both ways. The difference was our guys threw 7 or 8 a game, and the other team threw 2 or 3. I charted Glavin off TV all the time. If he was getting the ball off the plate, so was the other guy. You could say we got more pitches, but we made more pitches." And I think Greg Maddux is right. If you want to argue a little bit about Game 6, which was I'll give you some of Game 6, but you can't tell me the whole series, because the strike zone was wide in the 90s. It was. And pitchers expanded the zone, and Greg Maddux and Tom Glavine took advantage of that, just as any other pitcher could have. That's why you had 3 Hall of Famers in that rotation.
I'm stunned to hear that a guy who got the benefit of the doubt on a lot of calls doesn't want to believe that he got the benefit of the doubt on a lot of calls in a series that he won.
He doesn't say he did. No, he doesn't say that they didn't get the benefit. He actually agrees that the balls were off the plate.
Oh, no.
They just took advantage of it.
They just happened to throw more. Exactly. That's absolutely.
3 Hall of Famers. 3 Hall of Famers.
Who won the series? Of course they're going to defend their accomplishments.
No, but there's a reason they're Hall of Famers. And it's not because, like, the umps didn't just choose, we're going to give these guys the calls. No, these guys earned that through, not just through their careers, but in games. Like, you earn the benefit of that doubt.
One of the most controversial calls. I'm sorry, please finish. I was going to use a different example.
No, go ahead.
I was just simply going to say one of the most controversial calls in any sporting event I've ever seen is the pass interference call on Chris Gamble in the Ohio State-Miami game. Of course the Ohio State players and their fans are going to go, absolutely, 100%, that was a flag. And it was. And the Miami players are going to say, no, bullshit, that was a horrible call. And it wasn't. Because of course the people that won want to defend the calls that got them their win. That's natural.
These are parallel.
Yes.
So yeah, you got sour grapes and we got ring. So
that's fair.
Yeah. Yeah, we got two of them. Yeah. So, and what I hate is like when the thing that like legitimately I do kind of like and like makes me go, ugh, is I love Cleveland sports. And I try not to boast about 95. I very seldom do. I only do that when people, for whatever reason, talk shit about the team that beat them. Like, and it's not like we had a Yankees payroll or anything like that. Like,
yeah,
that team largely did did things the right way. I mean, didn't overpay for guys, made good trades, and
yeah,
you know, loaded that team up with Hall of Famers and good role players. Like Ryan Klesko was like one of our favorites. I mean, David Justice, not a Hall of Famer, but everybody knows him.
He
was a stud in the 90s. Let's just like all mutually agree to never talk about that series, because when y'all get like upset about it, it's like, you're gonna make me say shit about a team I like that I don't mean, because I'm gonna get because I'm gonna play along with it for a minute and then it's gonna get like, oh no, now I'm actually pissed.
It's weird. Thinking back on that era, I don't know which World Series upsets me more, because there was very much this feel in 95, like that was the start of what was going to be a very long run. And we got back to the World Series 2 years later, and we just happened to be really, really good at the same time. The Yankees were really, really good. I don't know. I love that.
You have to be more upset about the Marlins. Like the Braves, ran into a buzzsaw of a ridiculously good team. Like the Marlins came out of nowhere, didn't even want to win, and made it apparent by trading everybody in the offseason. Like,
I think it's...
And you had that series won.
Oh.
Do you have it won more than once?
No.
It was just game 7?
It was just, yeah. Okay. I actually don't think any team... I think that series literally went... We won every even game, they won every odd game, I think. I'd have to go back and look. I think 95 at times upsets me more because I loved that team more. That was that, for number one, that whole season was just so good.
Yeah, it did. It did snip snap.
Okay. The 95 season was just so good because we hadn't been in the playoffs in 41 years. So there was just this whole, like, we're finally back. They had so many late wins. And, you know, guys that you loved were still on that team. Albert Bell was still on that team. Kenny Lofton was still on that team. He wasn't there in 97. He was with you guys, actually. Mm-hmm. The 97 team, if you look back, like, comparatively, that Indians team, yeah, I mean, they made the playoffs, but I think they only won, like, 86 games. Like, it was not a very good team. And then they just happened to go on this really, really good run. I mean, that Baltimore team that they beat in the LCS was phenomenal. So I think that's part of it, is like, yeah, 97, we had it won, and, you know, you expect to win with Jose Mace on the mound. And I mean, he'd been lights out for 3 years. But I just don't think I liked the team as much as I liked that 95 team.
And so you hate me. You hate me.
Nah, I don't. What's funny is I don't even remember how that team came up. Matt and I just started talking, and it suddenly came up, and then, yeah, you weren't there.
Oh, because one of you was like, it's nice to talk about sports, and one of you was like, oh, Andrew just likes talking about the Falcons and the Braves. And I fucking hate talking about the Falcons. I hate it. I don't ever want to talk about that,
I'm going to try to take your boy tomorrow in fantasy.
Which one?
Bijan.
Oh. He's not my boy. I thought that was I did not like that draft pick.
It's high for a running back, but I think he could be really good.
It's high for a running back, and you had a 1,000-yard rusher last season who was a rookie. I don't like that. And you have so many holes all over that freaking team.
Are you surprised they didn't make a run at Trey Lance?
No, because I think they really want to see what they have in Desmond Ritter. I think there's a little bit of potential in Desmond Ritter. Mm-hmm. Slash next QB class is fucking loaded. So
yeah, it is. It's funny because you can already see certain teams are angling to try to get him. Like the Cardinals are in fire sale mode.
Yeah.
Man, here we are, a running podcast, 18 minutes in, and we haven't really talked running yet.
Nope, not yet. Don't worry, we're going to get there.
Yeah, sorry, guys. If you stuck with us this long, good for you.
There was just something I was trying to... Oh, yeah. You know, there's one other thing that I love that you do. Just going to defend my Falcons here. And I don't... Again, I'm not trying to, like, shit on Cleveland sports. I love Cleveland sports. I have a Browns hat, and I wear it during... But you guys love to bust my balls for 28-3 lead.
I mean, it's... Yeah.
In the middle of a 1-31 stretch of football. Oh, I mean, God. That's real ballsy to...
You can't
to
hurt
make,
us.
That's real Believe ballsy, me. Though.
You can't hurt us.
Fun. That's real ballsy to make fun of a team for losing in the Super Bowl.
Listen,
when you went 1-31.
You can't
and
hurt
kept
us
the same
this.
Head coach.
No, I mean...
That's just ballsy. I don't know, even if you say I can't hurt you, doesn't make sense.
In the last 20 years, we are probably the worst run organization in pro sports. I mean, that's just...
Oh, I'd agree with that.
There are the delusional Browns fans, and I'm friends with several of them who every season, including during that 1-31 stretch, would find ways to talk themselves into if the next mm-hmm. 26 things all go perfectly, we sneak into the playoffs.
Yep.
But I think anybody that can somewhat objectively look at the Browns, especially under Jimmy Haslam, can watch it and just be like, this is one of the worst run teams in all sports. If you watch the Johnny Manziel documentary, I mean, it just tells you everything you need to know about how poorly run the franchise has been. Because, I mean, we're not even talking red flags. We're talking like the red carpet of red flags is being rolled out. And the Browns are like, first round pick, we got them.
Yeah, but Matt was right. He hoodwinked hard. I mean, he did that in at A&M. I mean, he was, you know, how he got away with the money he took, which he should have been able to take that money. But, you know, I mean, him and his boy
yep.
came up with ways to get around all the money that dude made and just straight up lying about it.
Yeah.
I want to give him props for coming. He didn't come out, you know, with that documentary to like ask for pity or sympathy. Like he straight up is like, hey, I'm still going through shit, but I'm just at a point where I can talk about what I was going through.
Right.
And, you know, I thought that was one of the more authentic sports documentaries I've seen. I mean, he did not hold back. He didn't, and I don't think he tried to make light of things. Like even when the kind of comical moment when they're talking about his iPad and how he wasn't watching plays, you know, he just said zero. He wasn't like making a joke at it, scoffing at it. He's just like, yeah, I wasn't doing shit. Like, mm-hmm. and that's, it's not funny. It's not like he stole money from the Browns. He was pretty honest about that. I thought.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm glad to see, you know, a guy like that, you know, come out and, you know, be honest and authentic. And, you know, I thought that was a really good documentary, you know, all things about the Browns being hoodwinked aside. I hope that dude, I hope he gets through his shit. 'Cause, you know, everybody deserves a chance to get through and live life on the other side of stuff like that. So, whatever. I guess we can kind of end the sports stuff on somewhat of a non-confrontational note.
Sure.
But yeah. So, back to the conference. I'm going to continue to go with what really grinds my gears from that episode that you guys recorded last week.
Tapering?
Y'all made a little bit of fun about how I taper, which After I just completed a 16-mile long run today and had a 8 miles of speed workout on Wednesday, right in the middle of my taper. Guess what, guys? Taper is not race week. So I think the largest problem we have when discussing taper as a running community, you and I were discussing this a little bit before we started here, is I think we misdefine what taper is.
Yeah.
I see it on social media a lot. And I think even when you talk about the disagreements, like when you brought up the disagreements you and I have about taper, I think there was even some of that was, you know, wrapped into that misdefinition of what taper is.
Okay.
It's not race week. Race week is not taper. Race week is part of taper.
Mm-hmm.
But to taper is to gradually bring that mileage down.
Right.
And so that starts weeks out. And last week I did my peak workout, which was 20 miles. And I did 4 easy, 4 at 7:30 pace, 8 at goal pace, which is 6:55, and 4 miles cool down, similar to what you prescribed to Wolf and Team RBR member Abe Sanabria. I did that. And then from the moment I finished, my taper began, and I still did 42 miles this week.
Right.
And I will probably do about 30 next week, going very similarly to, you know, Matt brought up, you know, cutting off 10 to 20% of the mileage. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then I'm going to get to race week, and then that's where the differences are. Not as much anymore, but, you and I have both kind of gone to the middle.
Maybe do a little more
than I did, just slightly, but you do a little bit less.
Mm-hmm.
So, because you talked about how that worked for you at Boston. And I just want to say the whole theory behind that is just to, I feel like I said it, I don't know if I said it on the podcast, if I said it to you or if I said it to an athlete, but the only thing you're going to gain is percentage points to 100. You're not going to gain any fitness. You're just trying to get to 100%.
Yeah.
And as close as you can get, especially in my case, I've been battling this, you know, I guess it's an injury. It's not really been diagnosed thoroughly, but the work has been done to manage the symptoms and the pain. And I've gotten through what will hopefully be a 200-mile August.
That's good.
Yeah. And but it's, you know, it's going to be time to focus on just getting myself as close to 100% as I can, not trying to, you know, cram in last minute fitness, because it doesn't work. Just like cramming for tests don't work.
Yeah.
Cramming fitness in before a race doesn't work either.
You know, I as I was prescribing stuff for Abe, and I even texted him separately about this. You know, I told him, you know, starting this past week that we've gone through, where we're 3 weeks out from the race you guys are going to run in Erie. You know, I told him like, hey, this is the start of taper, and we still do quality stuff, but we're at the point now where what I want you to focus on isn't so much grinding to hit those paces. It's learning to let those paces feel easier as you run less and less. Because I think that's one of the hard things about grinding through marathon training. And marathon training, I think more than any other type of race training, truly is a grind with all the mileage that you do. You run a lot of mileage at faster paces that to me mimics what it's going to be like to run those paces late in a race, which is great because you don't want to go into mile 20 of a marathon expecting it to feel easy, because you're going to be sorely disappointed. You are going to be really disappointed, and it's going to make it mentally really hard to get through the next 6 miles. I think mile 20 in some ways is one of the most interesting moments in any sort of a race that you can run, because it's monumental to see that watch click over to mile 20, to go from 19 to 20, but also to start doing the math in your head and realize like, I still have, you know, however long it is for you for running. I think for me, it's usually about 45 to 50 minutes. And it's like, after doing that much running, to still think like I've got 6.2 left and that's gonna come out to like 40 to 45, maybe 50 minutes just feels like a lot. Like, man, I still have so much to do. You know, so it's great that training really helps you learn what that's gonna feel like. But the problem then is that you kind of forget what it's like to run those paces and have it feel easy. If you're lucky, you have a run where that happens, but you don't have too many of those, especially within the last probably couple of months of training. So I told him, like, I don't want you, you're not proving fitness at this point. You prove fitness on race day. Now the focus needs to be on, as this starts to feel easier, let it feel easy. Let a 6:55 feel easy now, where 3 weeks ago that might have felt like work. And I think that's, I told you before when we were talking about this, I think it's Greg McMillan, who's a coach, who talks about, he says, I hate the word tapering. Let's talk about peaking, because that's really what you're trying to do, is peak for the race. And I think tapering, you said really eloquently, like it's misdefined. It's seen as like this whole, like, just drop everything off 3 weeks before a race and just go into really kind of sit back, kick it easy mode. And, you know, if you're hurt or something like that, if you've been kind of working through some injuries and really just need to get to the start line healthy, that's okay. But if you're not, you really still need to be kind of polishing a little bit, getting that last little bit of work in. And you're not going to build any more fitness, but you can have that fitness feel sharper for race day. And that's really what the goal is.
It's all the fine tuning, you know, like on a violin, you have two different, gosh, I could have explained this way. I should have like looked this up thinking about this analogy. But you have two different sets of like tuning knobs. You have the more broad tuning, which is the bigger one up at the top of the neck that you're aware of, which is going to help you move much quicker between notes on the strings. And then as you get close, you have the really small knobs at the bottom of a violin where you can fine tune it. And that's really where you should be at right now, is just those little dials that you're turning back and forth to get yourself right. And I think we need to continue to focus on that. If you are sitting around, and this is, you know, where I think having a coach is very valuable, or having smart friends around you who can help you figure out what to do, because no two training cycles are the same. Nope. And I mean, I can look at the last 2 years and see two very different training cycles. I typically would not do 16 miles 2 weeks from race day. I would do like a half marathon, 14 miles. But I had 2 weeks a month ago where I wasn't doing a whole lot. And I was trying to, you know, get a little bit of extra fitness in there as we get closer to race day without being reckless. You know, that's where I'd like to throw it. Even if it's just a kind of a mental boost that I get by having yet another 16 miler down. Which I'm going to talk here in a little bit about kind of what the race plan for Erie looks like. You know, that 16 mile mark is going to be important. And I have, so I think I probably have like 10 16 milers since the beginning of June.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like that, maybe not 10, but 8, something like that, you know, that helps at least mentally. So, yeah, any help is good. So if it's just a mental boost, great. As long as it's not going to break you down, working on a mental boost is good. And I think that's maybe something you can grab. It's where a little bit of race pace work, I think, is good. I don't think you should be going and dropping, you know, lightning fast 400s or 8s or anything like that. But, you know, some race pace 1Ks or miles. Wednesday, I'll do mile repeats. I'll do 3 of them at race pace. You know, I'm just trying to feel that. I'm not proving anything. I'm just trying, especially because I haven't gotten a lot of the work in late that I wanted to get in, because it was back to so much base building after 2 weeks that were largely down. It's just trying to internalize that a little more and trying to find it. I will say, you were talking about making it easy. I was at the track on Wednesday, and me and Nate Perez are doing a workout. We ended with a race pace mile, and Bethany Haver took a video of us running, and it was on the race pace mile. Dude, it looks like a cool down rep.
Yeah.
And once I saw that, like Nate and I were talking about it after the run, the 16 this morning. And I'm like, dude, if it looks that easy, I got this. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, we just look like we were coasting, and I know it's only 1 mile, but I mean, it looked like nothing. And, that's confidence boosting for sure.
If you hadn't put in the thread that it was the race pace mile, I would have assumed that it was an 8 minute cool down mile. That's how easy mm-hmm. it looked. You guys looked like you weren't really working at all. And that is that's such a confidence boost. Like you said, when you hit those moments where you start to feel that little bit of fitness gain coming from tapering.
Yeah.
Where when that pace starts to feel really easy, there's always a run that happens the week of the race. I usually do like 1 6-miler really early in the week. And by that point, I haven't done a long run over the weekend at that point. I'm probably about 5 or 6 days removed from when I did my last hard workout. And it's like clockwork. I think it's usually on that Tuesday of race week. I'll be running and I will be working like I'm not really working at all. And I'll look at my watch and I'll be under 7. And it'll just blow me away because it feels like I'm doing an 8-minute mile. And that's mm-hmm. always that moment in race week where it's like, okay, we're good to go. Like, we're ready to do this.
Since I won't do a 6-miler, that's a lot for me to do on race week. But mm-hmm. I do dip a little further into maybe recovery mode. Mm-hmm. Dude, I feel like garbage every run race week. And I think there's a mental aspect to that too. Because I mean, I have high race week anxiety.
Yeah.
That's something I wanted to hit on real quick too. Mm-hmm. I have some friends who, you know, if they listen to this, they're going to feel like real dicks. And that's not the intention, but I never, you might be one of them, but I never want to, be corrected on how I feel. And if you have friends who are, you know, we're approaching fall races. Mm-hmm. I know when race week comes, I'm going to be thinking about dropping a piece of scaffolding on my foot at the end of June. I'm going to be thinking about the 2 weeks that were super down because of this cranky leg that I got and some of the stuff that I missed. And it's going to have me kind of all over the place. And that's mm-hmm. how I'm going to feel.
Right.
And I know that the reality is that I have put in a lot of good work, very comparable to what I did last year for Columbus. I came into this much faster, mm-hmm. coming off a significant PR in the half and a significant PR in a 5K. Like, I've done a lot of really good work and came in with a better base than I did last year. So, like, I know that, you know, my goals are within my reach. Doesn't change the fact that I'm going to be, you know, a nervous wreck. My goal is to run Boston next year and in 25. And the only way I do that, well, the only way I run next year is to hit my goal, at Erie.
Yeah.
And, I got one shot to do that. So it sucks. Like, it's I'm already like, you know, all over the place about it. You know, there's the inadequate feelings and all that, but it's like, that's just how I feel.
Yeah.
If you've got people around you who are talking a little bit negative about themselves as they approach their race week, allow them to feel that way. Mm-hmm. Don't try to correct their thoughts and say, no, you don't need to feel like that. Maybe you can augment it with the reality and say, I get what you're saying. I totally understand why you feel that way. But remember that you did do all of this. Remember that you are in this kind of shape too. Like, you know, that, cause there, if we can compartmentalize how we feel with a reality, when things feel good during race day, it'll make sense to me because I understand the reality.
Yeah.
So when I get out there and I'm at mile 6 or 8 and things are like, okay, my leg's loosening up. All right. I'm rocking 6:55s. I'm good. I can be like, yeah, cause you did all this fucking work. Cause you're a fucking badass. That's why. Like, all this shit that you were feeling all week was just your anxiety and, you know, being a bit of a basket case. And there's nothing wrong with that. So, I think just don't correct people's feelings. That's happened a lot to me as I've, like, explained to people, like, I know I'm going to feel this way. no. Like, I know it's well-meaning, so I'm not in any way, shape, or form upset with anybody who has done that.
Right.
But maybe just watch how you're, if people are telling you how they feel, don't tell them that they're wrong, because nothing is going to, that'll make people mad. So without that being the intention.
I used to tell my high school athletes before big games that that weird mix of emotions they feel before a big game is, it's the tax of putting the work and getting there to play in a big game. Because there were a lot, I was fortunate enough to coach some pretty good teams. And, you know, there were teams that I know never got to experience that. And there's players that would kill to sit in a locker room before a big game where, you know, the conference title is on the line and be able to experience those butterflies that never got to do that. And so it's like, it sucks because it doesn't always go your way, but man, like, it's the tax that you get to pay for even getting to that point. And it's not necessarily fun to go through. You know, you talked about, like, you're going to be thinking about all those things that didn't go right. I remember the week before Pittsburgh where I'd had a slight quad strain. It hurt that week. It hurt like a mother. Mm-hmm. And I, what I've realized is as I get older, my body's response during taper is just any little injury that I've kind of trained through that isn't a bad injury, just that little niggle that you kind of like manage. When I hit taper week and my body goes into, oh, we're done, like we're recovering now, it puts all its resources in recovering and it hurts.
Right.
And so I can remember that week, like doing shakeout runs and thinking like, how the hell am I going to get through 26 miles feeling this way? And then race day comes and I feel fine. And I've just realized like that's the process my body goes through now, but I've done the same exact thing where I'm doubting my ability to get through 26 miles because I'm in these little bouts of pain. And you've been really good because I've texted you that and you're really good about like, you'll be fine, man. Don't worry about it. You're good. But I know those feelings. I mean, and we have athletes that are like that. I mentioned last week that one of the things I do with like specifically race week, I like to have the same schedule. I don't do nearly as much mileage, obviously, but I like to have the same schedule. I run 6 days a week. And during race week, I typically do that too. And I have some athletes, though, who that drives them nuts. Like they truly need to just almost have like the most low key week, give them like 3 runs before the race and that's it. And I've just done that because you know what? Like why stress them out? There's nothing to gain that week.
Right.
To me, it's just truly about get them moving as best as they can so they're not stale, but also mentally get them in the right frame of mind. And if that means running less, okay.
You can also like give yourself option runs.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
That there's, you know, if you're really like, you know what, I'm not feeling it today. And I feel like I want to, you know, sit on the couch and put my feet up and compression boots or sleeves or whatever you feel like you need to do to, you know, aid some recovery, go for it.
Yeah.
You know, you need to keep blood moving and stay, you know, loose. You can't take the week off, but yeah, all that being said, I think our big difference has always just been race week, not necessarily taper itself.
Fair.
Maybe slight intensity differences, but I will absolutely chop off a run during taper. If I'm like, I remember last year we had a soccer game. It might've been like the first game of the, might've been the last game of the season.
Oh yeah. I remember this
October. And I was like, you know what? I don't want to run tonight, so I'm not going to. Like it was like the last like 8 months. It would be this Monday for me, and I was like, I just don't want to run, so I didn't. Like, and I was totally cool with it. And I mean, it didn't matter. I mean, maybe it did, but it was not going to be a minute 30 difference. So I do think, man. I tell you what, you're exactly right though when you're talking about your athletes. And how, you know, people would kill to be, you know, in that spot. Like, that's one thing that I thought about a lot this week was like, I'm very fortunate that I'm already this stressed out because I'm in a position to qualify for Boston at the second hardest qualifying standard. And it's, I've had the same qualifying standard since I was born basically, but, I'm very fortunate to be this close to this at 305 and, you know, it's not luck. I guess some of it is, it's what I've, you know, I mean, everybody can work hard and not even come close to it. Sure. You know, I'm fortunate to have the talent level I do just in my body. And, you know, just as, you know, you and Matt are faster than me, it's just, that's how we naturally are, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. You know, so I'm fortunate to have that. I'm fortunate to have done the work. I'm fortunate to have cut out some bad habits over the last couple of years. And I've put myself in a position where I can be this anxious about it because I do get one shot. And I just hope I don't miss my chance to. Oh, 8 Mile. God, I'm an idiot. So yeah, I'm very fortunate, and I'm very happy to have this thing. And I think it's kind of fun. I think it's kind of part of it. I think it makes the moment bigger. But yeah, it's my Super Bowl, you know? So I'm going to be anxious about it, and I'm looking forward to it.
And so what's,
2 weeks away.
What's your plan?
Oh, all right. So this race is going to be broken down into three parts. Okay. I'm taking it hour by hour, basically.
Okay.
Because that first hour, I think the beginning of any marathon I've had, you know, when I'm having that anxiety, which I always have, those first couple miles, I'm always like, how the fuck am I going to do this?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm like, you know, you hit mile two, you're like 24 miles to go.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. There's... And you're like, I mean, I'm working, like I'm definitely working right now, and I have a long way to go. And you know, then I have this cranky tendon nerve issue in my right leg, and it takes about 45 minutes to warm up and to loosen up, and you know, have any discomfort really disappear. Okay. So you know, that first hour is really going to be, let's just get through that, and then. You know, focus on that leg and it should be gone by the time that first hour is over. I'm not even gonna worry about distance, but I know first hour is going to be about 8.5 miles.
Okay.
Is about where I should be. And that middle section, Nate Perez and I were talking about this morning, that middle section, that's the bread and butter. Like that's the easy part because you're into the race. And, I'm just trying to run even splits. I think it's hard to try to run negatives at this speed, but it's, for me, it's just about this mental focus. And I think that middle section is really going to, I've never had a problem there. I've never struggled between like 8 and 16 because that's, you're making progress, you know, and you're getting deep into the race. You pass the halfway point. And you get to 16 and you're like, sweet, 10 miles, let's go. And then you're coming into the hardest part of the race. Yeah. And I don't fully know what to expect between the leg, between a course that has almost no elevation gain, which I've never done. How's that going to affect me, good or bad?
Yeah.
But I mean, it's all I can do is, hit the ball that's pitched. And so there's not really much of a strategy per se when running even splits. It's just trying to be prepared for everything mentally that can be thrown at me, no matter how far off the plate it might be. It still might be called a strike.
You know, you mentioned things being your Super Bowl, and man, something ran through my mind, and I'm like, "No, that's a dick move. I'm not going to go there."
Yeah, it's fine. Let's get to the playoffs. you guys almost signed Baker Mayfield to an extension.
No, we never offered him an extension.
But I think that's it's just trying to. Be prepared mentally for everything that may come at me.
Yeah.
In those last, 10 to 8 miles, I'm hopeful last year at Columbus. And I feel like I'm in extremely similar shape, maybe slightly faster, was that hill on Woody Hayes Drive at 18. That's what like accelerated the minute and a half I lost in the last 10K. And I mean, I held on for a little bit after that, but man, I just could not maintain. So I'm hopeful that without that, with, you know, trusting proper fueling, maybe not having some of the GI issues I had that weekend, I got some plans for the carb load that I think may, I don't want to talk about them because I don't want anybody to take my advice on something I've not tested. So, that I'm going to be testing on race week. Can't be worse than last year. So
I think that's actually going to be bigger than you might realize. Cause I think part of that losing a little bit of steam is that, I mean, you went through 2 days basically where you were really struggling to hold anything down. And I mean, that matters.
No, I was holding it down.
It was just running through you really fast.
Yes.
I was going to say that shit matters. That matters.
I lost a lot. I probably lost a lot of what I took in. Then I lost, I think I lost about 50 seconds that I had to go make back. That was the other thing
you know,
about last year was I had to run, you know, I was trying to run about 6:58 to 7 and I had to do, I had to do like 6:42s. 6:44, like I think I was doing a bunch of like low 6:40s, and it's like that's not what I trained to do. I mean, that's closer to what I would run for a half, and I had to do that for like 5 or 6 miles.
Right,
like that was not in my race plan, and you know, that between that hill, maybe what I lost. But, you know, I was able to, you know, take gels, which was awesome. Like, that didn't seem to bug me. Like, nothing really bothered me. It was like, once I got all the bagels out, I was good to go. So, but I got some ways that I'm going to, you know, maybe drink some carbs that I'm going to give a shot. And I'm going to try it next weekend. I'm going to take at least one serving and try to run on it and just see what happens. Not that I'm going to run with the stuff I'm getting, but that'll at least let me know if I'm going to have any GI problems that I don't foresee. But yeah, if I can have a decent carb, I'm also not going to try to hit the same carb number. I'm just going to try to get close to it because I don't want to be sick again.
I think that was one of the lessons I took away from my Boston carb load is there was a number in mind and I just realized like I felt super full. To the point of just like, why make myself miserable doing this? And I cut back a little bit. So I didn't hit my number, but I also didn't feel miserable and I felt okay on race day. This is why practicing this stuff is so important.
Yeah. Well, and I sent you, I think what I'm going to try to use, I wish I would have discovered that earlier and maybe given it a try for Glass City or for Hall of Fame.
Okay.
But you know, it is what it is. I drink their other products and they're easy on my stomach. So I feel like this should be just fine. And it's not going to be full of like flour and wheat and gluten and all that. That's going to potentially mess with my stomach. So yeah, if I can avoid that, you know, I think I'm going to be all right. And there's a lot of unknowns. I thought, in the middle of July, I thought that this was going to be a 26 mile celebration. I really did. Like that's how confident I was. And, everything changed. Everything changed when I got where I struggled to run and then had two very low weeks and I still have discomfort. You know, it's like that really does change things. So I'm a little more to last year where it's like, I guess we'll see what I got. And I'm okay with that. Like, I think that I do think there is a little bit of pressure removed with that. Like when it comes to this is going to be a celebration. What if it isn't? what if this celebration gets real tough early? What am I going to do? You know, if I go out and it's tough early, I kind of expect that. Like, you know, there's things I expect that I wouldn't have expected had none of this popped up. So I might be more prepared for some of the punches that the marathon can throw at you, having gone through some of this in training. And I went through some shit last year, literally, and, you know, with the tonsillectomy and all of that. Yeah. You know, so I'm, while that timing was way better for Columbus training than this injury was for Erie, you know, I've gone through stuff that's very comparable, and I think I might be good. Strava doesn't think so, but I don't give a shit what Strava or Coros have to say.
You know, it's, I didn't bring up the point because we kind of like moved past it when we were talking about tapering, but I think it's worth bringing up now, is that you and I have had this conversation throughout your cycle and how things have gotten kind of janky for you. And we've talked about how the consistency that you bring in before a cycle matters a ton. Yeah. And I think one of the mistakes people make when they think about tapering, and just when you look at training plans in general, like the cookie cutter plans you find, is those plans tend to focus a whole lot on just what is happening during that 12, 14, 16 week cycle. Because whoever's writing that plan really has no idea what you're doing beforehand. Right. Like, so often you'll read a plan and it goes, you know, this plan is designed under the assumption that you've been running 25 miles a month for the last 3 months. But really, the designers have no idea if you've done that before. And so I think one of the reasons why so many people focus on like just cutting everything out that last 3 weeks is because there's really no understanding of what you've done going into that plan. And so the entire building of fitness is just being done during that training cycle. And in reality, if you're training for your races in a way to really maximize what you're going to get out of them, you've been doing consistent work before that training cycle. So that if there is a little bit of a down period, it isn't like it blows up the entire cycle. It isn't like you go into your peak week and that's the most you've ever run and you really need to cut things out now because your body's near exhaustion. And that's not what you came into this cycle with. You've been consistent now for 2 years. And even though, yeah, you had that interruption last year with the tonsillectomy, if you were to look at what 24 months of running has looked like for you, it's really consistent with the occasional little dip because of something that's happened to you health-wise. And that's going to matter when you come into this race.
Or because I took an off season. Like,
And it was planned.
Outside of, you know, planned downs or maybe getting sick or, you know, things like that. Yeah, this has been the hands down the most consistent since June 1st when I quit smoking, June 1st, 2021.
Yeah.
You know, it's absolutely been the most consistent mileage I've put in over a 2 year period since I started running 9.5 years ago. God, I smoked for 7 years of running.
That still amazes me.
That is what it is. I've talked about that to death. So, but yeah, it's wild, and I'm ready. Let the anxiety start. I'm here for it though. I think it's fun. I think some of the race week jitters I do enjoy. I think some of it makes it feel like something special is coming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I do sometimes get real down. So I'll see how, like last year, I was down all week up until about 2 hours before I started shitting my brains out. I was down. And then I had like a good like 3 or 4 hours that week mentally. And other than that, I was just down.
About what?
I just didn't feel good mentally. I was like, this isn't going to be what I want. Mm-hmm. I don't think I've done enough. There was just a feeling. It just felt bad. Yeah. Okay. I don't know. Like a little doom. I felt all week like I was not in a good spot. And that I get that a lot. I'm trying to think of the other time. There's other times I've had that. I had it before Glass City. But that was because of travel and shit. Like, I came off an emotional high I'll still not forget. I stood in my front yard for a solid 5 minutes, just staring at my car going, I don't want to go to Toledo.
Yeah.
And, when that's the feeling, it's like, yeah, this, that's you're kind of set for failure. But that's a little bit of how I felt all of race week last week or last year. So I'll probably have some of the same. And that's just how I, but man, I can't wait to get Boston behind me. I really can't. I want that so badly. Because I don't want fretting like this. Because my plan is run Boston next year with Jolly Trot it, and then maybe run a fast half in the fall, and then actually race Boston in 25, and that will be it. That will be the last time I like put out race training and a race effort in a race of that distance. I'm just done with it. I don't hate it, but I just don't want to do it anymore. And you know, but I'm just like. So say I hit my goal in on the 10th. If I will go out to run sub 3 in 25 at Boston.
Okay.
And I won't care if I don't hit it. It won't matter. It won't matter. If I don't PR that race, it won't matter. And that's what I can't wait. Like, I will literally just get to go see what my fitness is, as opposed to like, I'm going to see what my fitness is. But if I don't, if my fitness isn't where I want it to be, I'm going to be really upset.
Yeah.
You know, I, that's a huge, there's a huge distinction in that.
Oh yeah.
And so yeah, I'm really looking forward to not having to do that again. So that, and understanding that puts even more pressure on really wanting to hit that 305 with that buffer. If not, I'm waiting until 25 to try it again. Cause then I will get the extra 5 minutes, and then I will just go run a 305 and have a ton, have a huge buffer and call it a day. But that's not how I want to do it. I don't want to do it with a time that I absolutely should run. You know, I want to do it with this. I want to do it with all the bullshit surrounding it.
You know, I absolutely know what all of that is like. I've lived all of it, and it sucks. Like, and it's, you know, you're talking about like going to a race and not, and just wanting to see what your fitness is and not worrying about what the ramifications are. I can still very much picture where I was at mile 10 in Boston when I made the decision, like, this feels easy and I've never run this fast in a marathon before and I'm going to go for it. And I don't really care what the consequences are. Like, I felt it was within my wheelhouse, but I knew that there was very much the possibility that I was overextending myself and that I was going to blow up in Newton. And I was completely fine with that. But I'd never had that feeling before in a race, because there was always that, man, if you blow up and you blow this cycle and you're able to get that BQ, you're going to kick yourself. So it's the weight that is off your shoulders. It's tremendous. And it sucks because, like I said, it's the tax that you pay for caring about something.
Right.
And we care about this a ton.
The one thing I will say that is different than in years, well, there's two big things that are different than in years past when I've had a quote unquote BQ or bust mentality. One, I don't have that mentality. Like, I understand I can still have a good day on the 10th if I don't qualify for Boston.
Okay.
If it's 82 degrees by 9 o'clock and I go out and I finish and I, you know, run as I give it my all, I can be happy with that. Like, it was 82 degrees. Like, you know, I understand that, like, there are things that can happen that will take it away from me, not something I'm doing. And, you know, I would be bummed as shit, but maybe I'm running Chicago 4 weeks later. So, you know, I
no big deal.
My dumb ass might just be like, let's go for it there. There is some of that. I talked about last year when I was going down to Columbus, I felt terrible. It felt like the worst hangover of my life. That's what I felt like driving down to Columbus the day before. Like, water didn't even sound appealing. That is not a good spot to be in the day before a marathon. But that was the first time, you know, that I thought, all right, well, I guess it might be Philadelphia. That was the first time I thought that. So I don't think it's bad to kind of hold things like that in your back pocket. Like, I do have, like, if the forecast comes out and it's like a low of 75, I'm gonna very strongly be like, yeah, this might be a training run for Chicago.
Right.
Like, there's a very good chance that something like that could happen. And I do have that. I have that that I can sit on, and which sucks. It would take next year away from me. That would be mm-hmm. the big downfall in that. But
yeah, for sure.
I don't remember where I was going with that when I started it. Sometimes I just start talking and I look for the end of a sentence. Well, what is that Michael? What is that Michael Scott quote? Hold on. Where? Sometimes I'll start a sentence and I don't even know where it's going. I just hope I find it along the way. that's how that thought felt.
Yes.
But I mean, maybe when people are starting, maybe you can hit the back 30 seconds button or whatever it is, and you can try to get the context again, because I don't remember.
But, it's been lost.
Yeah. So I don't know. I think what I was saying was I'm not in that BQ or bust mentality. That was one of the things that's different. And the other thing that's different is I am just way more fit and put in way better training cycles than I did back in those days. I don't know what I was thinking. When I go back and I look at 2016 Columbus training, when I thought that I was Boston qualifier ready and it was my only DNF. And I when I look at that, I'm like, two things. Dude, you fucking smoke cigarettes. Like, you're an idiot. I wasn't an idiot for smoking cigarettes. I was an idiot for thinking I could run a Boston qualifier while being a smoker. Because I don't want to ever like try to make people feel stupid for addictions, because they're hard. There was a reason I couldn't quit. I mean, dude, I look at the training and that's where I'm like, you were a really huge idiot. Like, I was not doing remotely close to what I'm doing now. And, I mean, I was fit as hell, but I was not ready to, without smoking, I still wouldn't have been able to come close.
Right.
So I just mentally am in a better place. Physically, I'm in a better place to do it than when I tried. Honestly, I even think last year, I don't think was an honest Boston qualifier attempt. I kind of knew. I mean, I said 3:07. That was what I said I was going to run. My goal was 3:05, but I was like, realistically, 3:07 is where I'm at.
Right.
Here, my goal is 3:02. I think 3:03 is realistically where I'm at. Okay. So.
It's funny because
see if I'm right 2 years in a row.
You and I both have the same reactions to looking at our early training, and it's why, honestly, like I always say as coaches, I think one of the most valuable things we offer is perspective, because we've made so many mistakes that you just 100%. Shouldn't make as a runner. And it's just eventually you learn and you grow your circle and you become more aware. But it's where, like, I look at some runners that I know have a ton of talent and I go, like, man, I really like working with people that want to get that perspective, because like we've made the mistakes. We know like what's going to work and what's not. And it's one of the, I think, the biggest things we offer our athletes.
Well, it's like, I without like throwing him under the bus, like look at Abe, like Abe hasn't put in a cycle like this ever. I mean, and I say throw him under the bus, he'd fucking tell you that. Like, I mean, he tells us all the time. He's taking Doug Smith off the leaderboards out there in Medina.
Like, not a real easy wolf. Days, by the way.
Right. Yeah. Doug can't do that. He's too old. Doug's, he's so much faster than me and I talk so much shit, but, he's putting in the best work he's ever put in, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's like to see him, you know, accomplish what he's accomplished in a short time with us is awesome. I'm gonna tear through. That was a pretty big week. I did, you know what, this training wasn't super terrible.
No, your training was good.
No, I'm talking about,
oh, you're talking 16.
So let's see, I'm gonna tear through. This was for Columbus, so it would have been the first week of July. That was bad. 30. Okay. So far, I'm supposed to be in the third week of training. I've done 12 total miles, 25, 33, 9. August the first week of August, I did 20 miles. Then I jumped to 43, 46, 54, 51, 18, 33, 23, 35, 17, 22. Oh, that was, was it. That was race week. Like, what the fuck was I thinking? Like,
yeah, you might be needing a little more volume in there.
Yeah, like
slightly.
And now it's also possible that maybe there was some treadmill stuff in there.
Okay.
Because like I really don't know. But I would not log treadmill miles like I do now.
Okay.
So it's very possible that maybe there's some treadmill stuff in there, but definitely not to make up. I mean, I had some good weeks. So you're right.
Yeah.
We are rambling. Sorry.
No, it's fine.
This off air. So that's why iMessage is amazing. I'm glad that popped up. Yeah. Let's wrap this shit up because I also need to go to the bathroom. All right. Well, everybody, we'll talk about Erie later. Hopefully if it's bad, I'm not talking about it. I mean, maybe we'll decide when the time comes. It's not going to be bad. It's going to be great. I hope you have a great time on vacation, Adam.
Thanks, sir.
I hope everybody has a great time with their kids going back to school. I know I will.
Enjoy that time to yourself.
The weather, and there's a lot of dust around this house. The weather's cooling down, so it's time to, you know, get a lot of you guys aren't. You're not peaking yet. You're getting there. We're getting there for Akron. We're getting there for Chicago and Columbus, where we got a lot of people running. And if you're up at Erie and you see me picking up the bib, or now don't say anything to me at the start line, but and maybe check my time before you say something to me at the finish line. I'm feeling. Feel free to stop and say hey. And Adam, we'll talk when you get back from vacation. Matt will be back with us too. We gave him the week off. He got hit by a truck this week on his bike.
Oh.
He's fine now.
He's fine. No big deal.
Yeah. All right. Well, until next time, guys, thanks for listening. Feel free to like, subscribe, review us on your favorite podcast platform. Share us on your social media channels. That'll help us reach other people. Go to restbeltrunning.com where you can learn more about us as run coaches and buy merch and support the show and Adam's deep sighing. So it's time for me to say, enjoy your miles, everybody.
I love my log.